From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Punk rock icon Henry Rollins turns rage into art.
I'm driven by a lot of, like, really kind of ugly anger. And so I have a lot of that in me, and it comes from a father who was terrifying and teachers who yelled at me, told me I'd never be anything. And so I descend from the sky and land on things really hard.
Ahead this hour, we talk about writing and comedy with the former frontman of the punk band Black Flag. But first, we want to hear from you. On Second Thought host Celeste Headlee is stepping down, and we're playing some of her best segments this week. What are some of your favorite segments hosted by Celeste? Give us a call and leave a message, 404-500-9457. You can post to Facebook or Twitter. We're at OST Talk. And remember that we might feature your comments on the show. Actor George Takei is a man who needs little introduction. He first warp-sped to fame as young Sulu on the original Star Trek, but he's since become an active voice in promoting equal rights for LGBT people.
Anytime you need to say the word gay, you can simply say Takei. For example, you could safely proclaim you are a supporter of Takei marriage. If you're in a more festive mood, you can march in a Takei pride parade.
It's okay to be Takei. It's okay to be Takei.
Allegiance, a play inspired by George Takei's experiences in a Japanese internment camp during World War II, debuted last year. My colleague Celeste Headlee spoke to him before the Atlanta screening.
Good to be here.
I wonder how far you are now from where you thought you'd be when you were in your 20s.
Actually, in my 20s, I imagined myself being a leading man in major feature productions. I reached for the high star.
But did you ever imagine that you would be in this position as a cultural icon, as a leader, not just in LGBT rights, but also at this point for refugees and the treatment of American citizens and civil rights?
Absolutely. And on the Broadway stage with a musical that is inspired by the internment of Japanese Americans. I never dreamed of that, and I was able to achieve that with Allegiance, which is going to be screened on a very significant date, February 19th. And it was on that date, 75 years ago, that President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed an executive order numbered 9066, which ordered all Japanese Americans on the West Coast. I was a 5-year-old child, but I was included in that, to be summarily rounded up with no charges, no trial, no due process, in the most unjust way, to be rounded up and imprisoned in these barbed wire prison camps simply because we happened to look like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor.
Many Americans think that could never happen today, right? But we're talking about an executive order that was upheld by the Supreme Court. Do you feel as though that kind of thing could happen? Is it possible to see history repeating itself even in 2017?
We are saying that just a few weeks after our current president, Donald Trump, signed another executive order on January 27th. Which incidentally happens to be the Holocaust Remembrance Day. He signed an executive order with a sweeping statement characterizing Muslims coming from 7 Muslim-majority nations as potential terrorists. So again, the echoes of that unjust incarceration that began in 1942 is being felt in reality today.
You know, I was just in the hair salon yesterday, and my stylist said, you know, I've never even heard about that. What are you talking about? What are they called, internment camps? How did we lose this history, which seems to be pretty important when we talk about the American democracy? Why do so many people not know about it?
It is still a little known and even less understood chapter of American history. I'm always shocked when I tell people, particularly in the Midwest and the East Coast, that I was in prison during my childhood simply because of my ancestry. It was my grandparents on both sides that immigrated here. My mother was born in Sacramento, California, the capital of California. My father was a San Franciscan. They met and married in Los Angeles, and my siblings and I were born in Los Angeles. We're Americans, and yet, because of our ancestry, we were put into these camps. It happened, and Americans don't know because of phrases like Japanese internment camp. It pushes it to a foreign country.
Meaning it sounds like they were internment camps in Japan.
In Japan. Run by the Japanese government. They were American camps, U.S. government-operated camps in the United States, imprisoning American citizens who happened to be of Japanese ancestry. And it's so important for us to know about that. But it's, you know, my mission in life has been to raise the awareness. But when I'm always confronted with that phrase, Japanese internment camp, I have to go through that whole history all over again, you know, because it sounds something distant, something isolated, not American. They were Americans, camps in the United States, in places like Arkansas, Arizona, Montana, Utah. That's America.
I mean, there were many Japanese Americans who lost their property, lost their businesses when they came back.
My family. My parents, my father lost his business, our home, our freedom, and we were put in these camps and impoverished. We were imprisoned for the duration of the war, 4 years. And when the war ended, as suddenly as they rounded us up, the gates were thrown open. We were free to go.
No compensation.
Well, at that time, we were given a one-way ticket to wherever in the United States we wanted to go to, and $25. We were supposed to start life all over again. And my brother was 7. My baby sister, who wasn't even a year old when we were in prison.
She was born in the,
her whole life, practically. She was 5 years old. Her
How
whole
do
life.
You come out of that, though, and not hold resentment for your country?
Well, when I became a teenager, I became a voracious reader. I read everything, particularly civics books and history books. I became fascinated with that. And I was taken by the noble ideals of our democracy. All men are created equal, endowed with an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I couldn't quite reconcile that with what I knew to be my childhood imprisonment. And so I had many long and sometimes heated discussions after dinner with my father. And I learned about American democracy from a man who lost everything in the middle of his life, that he had worked for. And he said to me, "I'll show you how it works." And the following Sunday afternoon, he took me downtown to the Adlai Stevenson for President campaign headquarters. And he introduced me to how our democracy has to work. People, passionate people who are dedicated to getting a good man elected president of the United States. And so I was taken by that. And I was there almost every night after school and on weekends working with them. Governor Stevenson of Illinois did not win. General Eisenhower did. But my father said, in a democracy, you never give up. You keep on keeping on.
The constant complaint you hear whenever someone who is in the performing arts speaks about politics is, why are we listening to this person? That person's just an actor. That person's just a singer. What do you say to especially politicians who constantly say that actors and performing artists shouldn't have a voice in politics?
Are they telling us that our citizenship as Americans ended when we made that decision to become an actor or a singer? It's even more important for those of us who have been blessed with the amplification of our voices that our careers give us. Those of us who have been blessed with this
influence,
the additional amplification of our voice, have a real responsibility to know what we're talking about. And I, as a child, experienced it. And as a teenager growing up, I experienced it when we first came out, and I started school back in Los Angeles. I had a teacher who constantly called me the Jap boy or the little Jap boy. That stung. What had I done to that old lady? I knew that she hated me. She ignored me when I raised my hand, so I quit raising my hand. But why did she hate me so much? She was a teacher. I was her student. But that was what we came, in quotes, home to. Our home was Skid Row.
So I wonder what differences you see. I mean, obviously, you were quite young when you were in the American internment camps. But when you compare that to what's happening now, you're obviously opposed to the travel ban that was...
Absolutely. It's that sweeping characterization of a whole group of people, you know, which is... Because we simply looked like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor. It was crazy. We were neither the enemy nor aliens. We were born in this country, raised in this country. That kind of irrationality, and the same kind of irrationality is happening now, as we're discovering when these people who were banned but with the stay are coming to this country. People who fought for this country, grandmas, are being reunited with their families. These aren't people that are dangerous.
So most politicians have pretty low approval ratings. You, on the other hand, have very high approval ratings.
Are you trying to get me to run for office?
Why have you never
Why
run for
office?
Why
are you
going to
curse me that way?
Ronald Reagan, there have been Donald Schwarzenegger, you know, Sonny Bono.
You know, Ronald Reagan, to his credit, in 1988, apologized for that imprisonment and paid a $20,000 token redress to all survivors who were alive at that point in 1988. This was something extraordinary for me. It proved to me that this country is big enough and confident enough to admit a mistake when they made it, much too late, more than four decades. And my father, who bore the burden of the imprisonment the most in our family, passed without ever knowing. He died in 1979, 9 years before Reagan's apology. And that token redress, $20,000, paid to all the survivors at that time, totaled up to $1.6 billion.
That's actor George Takei speaking with Celeste Headlee last year. Just ahead, Lana from FX's Archer drops by our studio. But first, punk rock icon Henry Rollins has tough words for the Trump administration. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Today, a man who wears many, many hats.
Salam alaikum, fanatics. It is now time to hitch up your thongs and fire up your bongs. And tonight, we got some songs that will definitely make you want to break out, put your underwear on top of your head, and cause a riot.
That is musician, actor, and radio host Henry Rollins on KCRW Radio in Santa Monica. Many know him best as frontman for the quintessential 80s hardcore band Black Flag. Since it disbanded, Rollins founded his own record label, his own band, Rollins Band, and he created his own show on KCRW. Henry Rollins came through Atlanta in January. My colleague Celeste Headlee caught up with him then.
Oh, hello.
So this is a travel slideshow, I guess, concert? Is it a performance? What do you call it?
Oh, well, when I'm on stage just on my own, a lot of the stories I tell are informed by the travel that I do. and I take a lot of photos. And so a few years ago, at the National Geographic Theater in Washington, they asked me if I would basically do a narrated slideshow. So it's photos I've taken pretty much from every continent. And so there's a story with every photo, and that's basically the show. A dark room, a nice screen with high-resolution photographs with me in the dark talking about them.
What kind of camera do you use?
I use Canon bodies just because they're easy for me to understand, and you can't break them.
Do you drop cameras sometimes?
No, but when you travel hard, like pretty much any travel you do in Africa ages everything. Like you'll take a new pair of boots to a month in Africa and you come back and the boots look like you've worn them for 20 years. Everything just gets road hard in Africa. And when you just travel with a backpack for weeks at a time, things get knocked around. And as careful as you want to be with gear, you can't be careful enough with a lens or anything. So I just try and get like what I found to be indestructible. And I'm not trying to do an ad for Canon. It's just gear that has never failed me.
So I want to play this clip of you. You do all kinds of different shows. This is a piece of a Comedy Central feature that you did. And you're talking about a journey you took with a former colleague from Black Flag.
And we make a left into some huge supermarket, and we go right to the meat section. And he grabs a steak in its cellophane and styrofoam, tears it open, rips the meat in half, just hands me half of it. And he plunges part of it into his mouth, and he's eating it. I'm like, and I start eating it too. The entire supermarket is just silent, looking at these two men.
So I wonder, is there something particular about travel that makes it for good stories, or can you just make a story out of anything that happens in your life?
Well, for me, me plus travel pretty much always equals something interesting. It just depends on how you travel. I think geographic displacement, like to get you out of your normal, like right now I'm in my office.
Yeah.
I know everything in this room. It's appallingly familiar to me. And it doesn't quite inspire. And that's why when I'm off the road, I'm just usually editing. I'm just taking materials from the road, writing photos, whatever, and preparing them for, something. Or I'm getting ready to leave on a tour or something. So when I'm off the road, I'm basically preparing for the next, voyage. And my life, for me, it happens out in the world. When I'm home, I'm kind of on pause. I'm in preparation mode, which is fine, but I'd much rather be out in it. And I think that's where all the real stories are, and that's where all the life is as I see it. And that's why I always bring a camera, and I'm always writing things down, because I'm always looking for a story to tell somebody.
So one of the things that you do while you're home is your radio show at KCRW. I want to play a clip of one of the interviews that you've done. This is an interview you did with Ozzy Osbourne for the Henley Rollins Show.
Like back in the day when Sabbath was, making, the early records, I'm sure you guys got some of the most incredible bad reviews known to man.
We never, ever got a good review.
Right.
And you know what? If we did, we didn't like it. Because we were a people's band. We didn't.
Well, yeah.
We didn't think some executives should say we're
well, you got bad reviews, but every tour sold out, and because yeah. You're the people's band.
So what is it that keeps you going back to the radio show?
Oh, it's the I wear a lot of different hats, I guess, so I just say yes to everything. I've wanted to have a radio show since I was about 12 or 13, because I was one of those shy, introspective types who cries when the ball is thrown at his head. And so being alone in my room with my records and the radio was kind of my little universe. And I loved hearing the person talk to me between songs. And I liked the songs. This was, 70s AM or FM radio, so it was really, really good music. But I liked hearing what the guy was saying or what the gal was saying between songs. I wanted to be that person. And after seeing that scene with Wolfman Jack in American Graffiti and hearing his voice, he was syndicated for a little while, and I would listen to him in Washington, D.C., where I lived. And I was fascinated by this, you can't see this person, it's all about the voice, and you just kind of wondered what they were really like. Like the Dreyfuss does in American Graffiti. And I wanted to be that person. And so many years ago in the early 2000s, I was offered a slot at Indy 103, a station that went away.
Yeah.
And after it went away in 2009, I guess it was, Jason Bentley, my boss, one of them, called me and said, "Hey, I heard about Indy 103. I'm like, "Yeah, Pylon." He went, no, we're sorry about that, but we'd love to have you over at KCRW. And I said yes to that so fast, I think I sprained my jaw. Because it's such a great job. And so I've been there, I'm closing in on about 500 shows I've done at KCRW. April of 2018, I think will be 9 years there. And I'm always relieved when they don't fire me. I have a fear of it. And I love my job there, and I really like turning people on to music. It's like the funnest of all the things I do. It's the lowest pressure. Like I just came back from a trip where the first thing I did was a keynote speech, and then I flew to a location, and the next day was in a pilot for a TV show, and then I flew immediately from that to Luxembourg to be in a movie for almost a month, and I just returned a couple of days ago. And so that's a lot of juggling of chainsaws and a lot of, you know, check your stomach so you don't, you know, lose your lunch on your way to work. But the radio show doesn't have any of that trepidation for me. And so having a lower stress gig now and then, because everything else I do is, you know, hey, don't screw this up. Okay. The radio show, I don't know, I just really enjoy when I get that letter from someone like, I never thought I'd, would like jazz music, but you turn me on to John Coltrane, and now he's like my favorite musician. There you go. Or I get a letter from a band like, hey, we're getting all these people at our shows every night on this tour saying they heard us on your show. Thank you for playing our record. That's why I have a radio show.
So let me play a little bit, just so everyone can remember how most people first heard the name Henry Rollins. Let me play a little bit of early Black Flag. This is Rise Above.
Rise, stop, what we do. Rise above, we're gonna rise. When they can't do it themselves, rise above, we're gonna rise above. Way up high, up your abuse. Try to stop us, it's no use.
I think some people may be surprised to hear you describe yourself as a young, shy, sort of introspective person, because your persona, at least in the punk rock scene, was so very not that.
Art, if you will. That's a little highbrow. But music or some kind of artistic, like non-lethal playground gives you a place to really let it out. I had all that in me. It's just that, where do you put that? If you do it in the schoolyard, you get thrown out or you get arrested. If you do it at your workplace, you get fired. And so you do it in the practice room. And when I saw punk rock bands play, I was like, oh, well, I should be doing that. I mean, that's the place to put a crazy person like me. And many years ago, I was watching a band who I grew up around called the Bad Brains, a famous band.
Yeah. Yeah.
And HR, the singer, came up to me and he said, you know, Henry, you're a singer. And I said, no, you're a singer. Actually, you're the singer as far as I'm concerned. Kind of still is. And he said, nope, you're a singer, and tonight you're singing with the Bad Brains. And he literally that night grabbed me out of the audience, put me up on stage, handed me the mic, hopped off the stage, stood in front of the stage with his arms crossed, scowling at me like, go, sing. And I kind of knew some of their songs. I saw them all the time. And so we sang a couple of songs. And, you know, I don't know, I forget what people did. I was like 19 or something. And 18, I forget. Anyway, he took the mic back and said, see, you're a singer. And that was a hell of an endorsement. And so that's kind of how I got into all of that. I can be on stage and kind of be anything I want, and I can kind of sort of do that in acting. But if you, say, come to my birthday party, I will absolutely freeze with trepidation.
So a lot of the things, themes, social issues that punk was sort of fighting against or singing about are still present with us today. I read an op-ed that you wrote about President Trump not very long ago, and I wonder if you think there is just always going to be this battle between authoritarianism and liberty or tyranny, I guess, and governmental forces, or is there something different that's changed in the past year or so?
I think you'll always have struggle between those in power and those who see themselves as not or powerless, just because the human brain is so high functioning. Unless you are kind of morally intense, some people will fall prey to, well, why can't I have twice this? And he's not defending his all that much. I'm gonna go take his. And that's how wars start. Well, we're gonna move the border over a few hundred miles. Hey, that's our land. Well, it was. You got something to say about it? And that's, you might think, well, that's people acting primal. No, that's the human brain in fifth gear, actually. You know, we just want more because we're high function. We get bored easily. And that's why more drugs, more this, more that, crazier video games, because we acclimate very quickly. And so you almost have to put a stick in the spokes of your bike to be fair. And I'm not saying we're all looking to take someone else's stuff. I'm just saying it's kind of amazing that America hasn't ripped itself to pieces a few more times since 1865 cooled off, because people just want what they want, and they don't always are able to employ the brakes and go, whoa, that's not cool. And so you're always going to have misogyny, a certain degree of it. I've seen homophobia, racism, and misogyny in the almost 100 countries I've been to in my life. I think you might have less of it as maybe America embraces science more. And whenever I meet a young woman, a girl, you know, like some 10-year-old girl, a friend of somebody I know, or a daughter, I always say, you know, just know this as a young girl, a young woman, this century is the century of women. And I hope you're a part of that, because this is it. This is where I want to see women change the game. I would love to see women flip the script. And we've tried it. We're men running it for the last, since we crawled out of caves. Let's try something else. And let's give that a few thousand years and see how we go. I'm in. And so I think you might see things getting better with the more women can wrest power away from men. And I think in the last several months, I'm just optimistic, but I think I'm starting to see the beginning of that. And so that's where my optimism lies, where maybe in 2030 something, we're looking at any politician who has, you know, any idea of homophobia or racism or some religious zealotry that's kind of terrifying. We just go, nope, like you're not getting out of the gate, because we're just not there anymore. And punk rock, as an old man looking back at it, I guess what we were doing in a way was folk music, because if you look at the lyrics of Black Flag and a lot of stuff I did, it's civil rights what we were angry about, you know, and that was the beefs that we were all engaged in when I was in Washington, D.C. as a young punk rock guy. We, all of our friends were gay and weird and anarchists and black and white, and we didn't really have those hang-ups. Like, well, there's a bass player in that band who's a girl. We're like, well, that's just the bass player. Like, we weren't exactly all PC and ready to, but we were not hung up like that. And I it was kind of idyllic for a little while. And maybe that's where we can go. I think what a lot of Americans are seeing now is how bad it can get. There's some Americans who might even miss George W. Bush, who could finish a sentence a lot better than some presidents. And so while it's easy to get down in the mouth, I think when you struggle for what's good, I think we stand a chance.
That's Henry Rollins, once the frontman of the punk band Black Flag. He now enjoys a prolific career hosting radio, doing comedy, and appearing in TV and film. Just ahead, Aisha Tyler on what it takes to be the voice of a badass animated woman. This is On Second Thought. On Second Thought, I'm Adam Ragusea. We at On Second Thought are huge fans of the FX animated show Archer. For those of you who don't know, the main character, Sterling Archer, has an obsession with a certain woman.
Lana. Lana.
Lana!
What?
Lana. Lana.
Lana!
What?
Lana. Lana.
Lana!
What?
Lana is Lana Kane, the lead female character on that show. She and Archer have a love-hate relationship. And more often than not, Lana is saving Archer's butt from almost certain death. Lana is voiced by actress Aisha Tyler. She joined my colleague Celeste Headley last year to talk about Archer's eighth season.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us.
Good. Thanks for having me.
So, the Lana Kane, the character herself, used to be, it looks like, from the storyline of the show, she started out as an activist and got recruited to be a spy straight from the protest line.
Yeah, I think Mallory Archer saw some kind of a kindred soul that day. For people who haven't seen the episode or who don't know the show, you know, Mallory Archer is Sterling's mother. She runs a spy agency. All spy agencies are clandestine. This is clandestine even from other clandestines. And she meets Lana when she's kind of a, you know, this hyper-intellectual college activist. And she's also an anti-fur protester. And she goes to throw blood on Mallory's fur coat.
Fur coat, yeah.
I might have been red paint. And they have this kind of standoff where, you know, Mallory, who's, you know, killed men for less, threatens Lana, and Lana doesn't blink. And in that moment, they fall in a very specific and moderately platonic kind of love. And Mallory recruits her to become a spy.
Yeah, although she sees
she sees a deadness. She sees a deadness in Lana's eyes that she connects with.
The lack of spark. And yes. I don't know if Lana knew how to fight before she joined or she was just a really good study, but she is the one that actually is often the most lethal. Take a listen.
Our agents are highly trained in many disciplines. Like Krav Maga.
My arm! You're breaking my arm!
I'm sorry. Did that hurt?
Do you think of Lana as a feminist character?
Oh, 100%. And I think of her as a feminist in the most modern sense of the word, in the sense with the most clarity. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of dogma in any kind of like movement, but I think, you know, Lana is a progressive in some ways. She's, you know, maybe, well, I mean, in the beginning, I think we talked about her, Adam Reed and I, the creator of the show, as a kind of a closet Republican. So, you know, she has these kind of progressive ideals, but she also is potentially an economic conservative and a social liberal. So she's complex. And I think that is the embodiment of the modern feminist, which is that women are not a monolith. But I think at her best, at kind of her core, she's just a self-determining woman. And she wants what she wants, and she pursues it with vigor and aggression. I mean, everything from being, you know, essentially the only senior spy at this agency other than Mallory, having her eye on the chairwomanship of this organization, being in the field with all the other men, being a better spy than all the other men, and also eventually becoming a single mother. on her own, you know, by choice. She's just, you know, she embodies the idea, the feminist idea that everyone should be the architect of their own destiny and also kick a lot of butt.
She does kick a lot of butt. And she also has almost a perfect foil to sort of express her own individuality and strength in Sterling, who is not quite as progressive. Here's another clip.
Baby crazy?
That's why I dumped her.
You little, what? You suck what? Of I dumped you because you're dragging around a 35-year-old umbilical cord!
See?
So how much of the dialogue is printed? How much do you get to play around with it?
These scripts come to us in perfect, immaculate condition. I mean, there's never a need to embellish because the writing is so brilliant. Sometimes Adam gives us opportunities to improvise. You know, hey, ad-lib something here. But the show, as you see it, it springs wholly formed from the brilliant mind of Adam Reed. And I think none of us ever come in thinking we know better than him.
Yeah, although you're reading your lines not to each other, not to fellow actors.
No.
Yeah. Are you alone in your booth?
Yes. So we're not even all in the same city.
Right.
Chris and Judy and I are on the West Coast, and John and Jessica are in New York. And then Amber and Lucky, who play Pam and Krieger, are in Atlanta. So
Archer is like a footnote on your career right now. I mean, you've got the Criminal Minds thing. You've got you were obviously a lot of people were first introduced to you through your role on Friends. When I mentioned that in the newsroom, they said, oh, yeah, the smart one. And then
that's nice.
Talk Soup. You have your own talk show. You do a podcast. I mean, you've written a couple books. You just directed a feature film called Access, which is going to be released this year, right?
It's going to be it literally is having its world premiere the first week of April at the Sarasota Film Festival.
So what planning software do you use?
Brain, which is clearly malfunctioning right now. I need to update Brain because Brain software not working. You know, I don't have. It's funny. I am kind of obsessed with effectiveness, but I don't use any high tech software to organize my day. But I will say that I do. You know, I think my life is kind of 90%. Joyful play and in an area that I'm wildly challenged and engaged by. I love what I do. And then 10% crippling workaholism. And I it always comes across as a joke, but I'm serious. Like, I'm only happy, and I've said this before, when I have the penny taste of panic in my mouth. That's when I know that I'm alive, is when I think I might not live through today. So, you know, people jump out of planes. I just overcommit.
You just overworked yourself. And you're kind of famously
exactly.
a passionate home brewer. Do you get much time to do that?
I don't get to do anything of leisure whatsoever in my life at all. All of my hobbies have fallen by the wayside. I did homebrew quite a bit when I was younger, and it just I just ran out of road in terms of, you know, hobbies. For the last 4 years, I've been able to do some collaborative brews with Stone Brewing in San Diego, which has been really fun because, you know, I get to go to, you know, it's nothing more fun for a homebrewer than to go to a real brewery with these giant, you know, mash tuns and get to make beer with professionals. And then leave and have them take care of everything else. So every year I do a collaborative brew with them, and that's always a lot of fun. And we do a big charity event called HopCon that happens right around Comic-Con. And so I get to kind of dovetail two of my passions, which is, you know, beer nerdery and
just
all
regular
other
nerderies.
Just regular, you know, run-of-the-mill street nerdery.
I mean, you mentioned Comic-Con, so I wanted to ask about your reaction, I mean, which at this point has to be getting old, when your credentials as a nerd are questioned. The entry into nerdism and geekism seems to, for some people, be limited.
And reserved for men and reserved and precluded for people of color? Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that get old when you go to these cons?
Yeah, I mean, it's tiresome. I don't get outraged by it. You know, I think that when you are an excluded group, you can develop this kind of, I don't know what the actual term for it is, but when a group is hazed and then they return and haze as viciously or even more viciously the group that follows. But I think you have a group of people that's been excluded for most of their lives, and they finally have something that they feel is theirs, and they don't see that they're employing the same kind of exclusive strategies that were used against them when they were growing up. They're not even always aware of it. But it doesn't affect me personally because it is who I am. It's not a choice that I made. And I had Seth Green on my podcast several years ago, Girl on Guy, and we were talking about kind of taking on the mantle of nerdery. And he said, you can't call yourself a nerd if you didn't spend a significant amount of your childhood playing alone. And so by that litmus test, you know, I should be reserving a cape of some kind or a crown, because I mean a big part of my childhood was playing in my backyard alone, playing on my playground alone, reading on the bus for hours until I missed my stop and had to be collected from the turnaround lot. I was a very isolated kid socially, and I was a big reader, and I had glasses, and I was the only black kid in my school. I mean, at the time that. You know, that felt like a pariah state. You know, I was lonely, but it was everything that made me who I am today. So when people challenge it, it doesn't matter to me, because it's like telling me that, you know, I don't know that you know, you're not nearsighted. Well, I am nearsighted, and I wear contact lenses. And no matter how many times you say it, it's not going to undo the fact that I can't see a thing when I get out of bed in the morning. You know, so those challenges, they're meaningless.
So I have to ask you this about Wikipedia, which I always scan before I do an interview. And the reason I scan it is because you often find weird stuff in there, and I don't know how it arrived. So I have to ask you this, because Wikipedia makes it sound like you would never have gone into acting were it not for your crush on Sam Rockwell. Because they say you followed him into an improv class and basically never left.
That is true. That is absolutely true. And who knows if I would have gotten into acting or not. My mother says I was always this kind of presentational ham. I think I was a subtle and thoughtful, tiny intellectual. But, you know, we can dispute that on an ongoing basis. That is a true story. And when I interview people on my podcast and I ask them how they got into acting, I will tell you that 95% of them say it's because of a girl or a boy. I mean, it's always, I have a line. I say it. It's always a girl. It's always a girl. Guys are like, there was this cute girl in acting class, and I followed her in there. And the girl and I never dated, but, you know, acting and I fell in love. And it is very true that I went to school with Sam Rockwell. I had a big crush on him. I followed him into an improv class, and I fell in love with the improv class. And I might have found my way there anyway, but that is not apocrypha in any way. And in fact, Sam and I are still very, very close friends to this day, and he makes a little cameo in my first film. So,
did you ever date him?
Yes, we did. We dated. Oh, yeah. Oh, look at me. Of course we dated.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking.
For no reason other than curiosity, we dated.
We'll see. There you go. You got to get it out of the way. You got to rule it out. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with actress Aisha Tyler. She voices Lana Kane on the animated show Archer, which is made right here in Atlanta. So this is probably going to be another weird question I have to ask you, because there's one thing that Lana's really well known for on the show, and it's these long rants. Here's an example.
So
what? Anxious about a half-drunk first-time driving a submarine idiot taking me to the bottom of the ocean to face 40 eco-terrorists led by a crazy person who's about to bomb the entire East Coast with nerve gas?
I was gonna say...
What? What were you gonna say?
So, does it hurt your voice? Do you have to do stuff to protect your voice?
I love how practical of a question that is. It does hurt my voice. And in fact, sometimes we'll save those rants or the screams for the end of the show, because I don't have a delicate voice, but it just is under an additional amount of pressure than most people experience. You know, I work on a talk show where I'm required to talk for a living. And then I do Archer, which requires a lot of talking. And then when I'm doing my podcast, that's 90 minutes typically of conversation. So it just is strained more than most voices. And I have come out of Archer sessions virtually hoarse, like having coming out with kind of laryngitis, no voice at all. So we try to kind of be strategic about how we do those scenes. And I think if you listen back to some episodes of Archer, I can't tell you which ones because I clearly have a terrible memory. There are some where I am barely able to speak and I'm kind of forcing it out, which is fine. I mean, you know, I'm a vocal athlete. I can get through it. But she's a demanding lady, Lana Kane.
So what is the difference? What's the difference in the job itself between doing the voiceovers? And you've also done voiceovers for video games like Halo.
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference in the acting itself between that, where you have only your voice, and just doing a regular scripted show?
It's a good. That's a good question. I find kind of the work I do to be kind of performance decathlon. You know what I mean? Like every aspect of being an actor, in the same way that every aspect of being an athlete, they're complementary. So I don't think about them as being really different, but just kind of different facets of the same job. But it is much more, in some ways, technical when you're just using your voice, because you've got to create a feeling for the person who's listening that is more, you know, you've got one tool to do multiple jobs, which is to give them a sense of character, a sense of place, experience. You're trying to interact with people who you're not actually speaking with. You know, I don't want to dismiss the other acting work I do, because I think it's all challenging. But when you've got other people in the room and you've got props and you've got wardrobe on, you're able to kind of relax into the moment in a way, because there are other things doing some of your job for you. But with your voice, you've got to accomplish a lot with just sound.
So, you know, you'll get into relationships and in like the third or fourth date, you'll start predicting whether that relationship will last.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you do the same thing with your acting projects. And if you do, if you thought Archer would make it to season 8.
Well, first of all, I go into every acting relationship thinking that it's doomed. And it's going to end with me standing in the street burning a pile of clothes with kerosene. So, yeah, you know, you go. Every actor goes into this job thinking this is all going to end terribly for me. Nothing's ever going to go. Nothing's ever going to work. I'm going to be fired during the dress rehearsal. With Archer, I didn't even think it was going to get ordered. So this has been 8 years of gravy, quite honestly, because I remember reading the script and thinking this is too smart, too funny, too dirty, too literate to ever get on television. But I thought it's going to be a fun pilot to make. I'll make a tiny bit of money, and I'll get to meet the guys behind C-Lab 2021, which was a show I was obsessed with in the kind of late 90s, early 2000s. I remember watching it when I was on Talk Soup and just wanting to tell everybody about this incredible, crazy show. So I just thought I was going to get to meet the C-Lab guys and you know, get a visit to Atlanta. And I was confident it was not going to get ordered. And so every single season when we've got picked up again, it's always a delight and a surprise. And I'm so proud of this show. I mean, it's something that I think every time we are making it, I'm just delighted that I'm a part of it. And I know it's unique. I think a lot of shows aren't as specific and as incomparable as this show. There's not really anything else out there like it. And so I'm just thrilled to have been a part of it in any way.
Well, you know, they throw a pizza party always on the season premiere. If you did want to come to Atlanta, you would get free pizza.
Well, far be it for me to buy a plane ticket in order to have a slice of Domino's. But you know, a girl can dream.
That's Aisha Tyler, actress and the voice of Lana Kane on the animated FX show Archer. She spoke with Celeste Head late last year. And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. We are asking what your favorite Celeste Headlee segments are. She is stepping down as host of On Second Thought. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post to Twitter. We're at OST Talk, and we're on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusa. Have a good one.